said Nekonk woodenly. After a moment he started down the shadowy street, and Sheftu fell in beside him. They walked in silence through the alleyways and byways into the warehouse district edging the wharf. When they came to the customs dock, where their ways separated, Nekonk faced around doggedly.
"Look you, Sashai, I know as well as you what's at stake in this, and if the maid trips herself up, well, it's her own doing, and I've naught to say for her. But if that vessel's raided tomorrow night, mate, I could whisk her on board the Beetle and sail straight for the Delta. She'd be no danger to anyone. You'd never need see her again. But you could still spare her life."
His voice trailed into silence. Sheftu was slowly shaking his head.
Chapter 21 The Quarry. Darkness lay thick next night about a certain warehouse on the riverfront of eastern Thebes. Some distance away from it, at the water's edge, a yellow glow of torchlight spilled across the wharfs from the decks of the Friend of the Wind, which lay close in against the dock to receive her cargo. They were still loading her. Figures moved against the light, humpbacked with burdens as they filed up the gangplank and across the deck. There were the usual thumpings and slammings and bellowed orders. Above the lighted decks, the tall, black mast swayed gently against the stars. Beyond, the dark length of the river wound away southward, splashed with gold here and there, wherever a torch burned. In the gloom beside the warehouse wall, screened by a pile of fishnets and old lumber, Nekonk heaved a sigh of impatience and tried for the 50th time to get comfortable on the coil of damp rope he was sitting on. Sheftu, a dim blur in the shadows beside him, seemed not to have moved for an hour. The captain wondered bitterly if he had fallen asleep. For all the anxiety Lord Sheftu exhibited, one would think he had come here merely for a breath of air. As for Nekonk, it had been the longest day he had ever known, and he'd made rough weather of it, alternating between bellowing ill temper and silent worry, until by mid-afternoon every man in his crew was keeping a wary eye on him, and his own nerves were taut as a straining hawser. He felt even more tense now, lurking here like a heft at the edge of darkness. The captain eased his shoulders back against the rough wall and tried to make his mind a blank. The reek of fish and hemp and rotting wood rose strong about him. Inside the warehouse, he could hear the loud scratching and scrabbling of a rat. Beyond the edge of the pile of nets, the burdened figures moved monotonously back and forth in the torchlight from the dock to the Friend of the Wind. Nekonk found himself automatically checking her trim.
"Overloaded on the port side," he muttered with gloomy satisfaction. "Cargo master's a fool."
Sheftu's voice came out of the shadows, cool and ironic.
"It scarcely matters, does it?" "Of course it matters. They'll have to shift half of those bales before they're well into the current. What do you mean, it scarcely—"
"I mean, they'll likely not be sailing."
Nekonk abandoned the subject, shifting his position once again and cursing irritably at the prickling roughness of the rope.
"Patience, Captain," soothed the other. "It cannot be long now."
"By all the gods, is he even human?" thought Nekonk. "Do you care not for what happens to the maid?"
He got no answer. But Sheftu's voice was a little less smooth when he spoke again.
"You tied the boat where I told you to?" "Aye, in the papyruses at the far end of the wharf. It's ready."
They were silent again. After a time, Nekonk twisted around to scan the black mouths of the alleys, still quiet and deserted, then squinted up at the stars.
"By the beard of Ptah, if it isn't the mark of 8 by this time, I'm no riverman."
He stood up, checked the alleys one by one, then sized up the stack of bales on the dock.
"Mate, they've all but finished loading. Look yonder. I'll wager a sail to Ashenti, the hour's 8, or past.
He stood clenching his fists to keep them from trembling. It should happen now. It should have happened already, if it was to happen. He realized Sheftu had risen too, and was standing stiff and erect at his side, scarcely breathing. Still, the minutes crept past. The commonplace sounds of loading went on.
By Amun, she's won, thought Nakonk at last. She didn't take our cursed bait. All's well.
He opened his mouth to blurt it out, and felt Sheftu seize his arm.
Captain, look.
A light shone in the mouth of one of the alleys. Nakonk tried to blink it out of sight, pretend that it was moving the other way. But it came on, brighter and nearer, accompanied by pounding footsteps. A knot of soldiers burst out onto the wharfs, with more at their heels. They were regulars and green helmets. There was a shout of surprise from the loaders, a roar that answered it.
In the name of the Queen!
Next moment, the night was alive with running men, with torches and glinting blades and a confusion of yells as the raiders poured across the wharf and up the gangplank of the Friend of the Wind. Nakonk dug both fists into his forehead to shut out the sight. Name of Amun, she's only a child, he thought. A waif, after all, who's seen naught but ill luck all her life, and needs friends and a chance.
So be it. I've seen enough, said Sheftu quietly.
Nakonk had seldom in his life been afraid of anyone, but he was afraid now of the tall young man who stood beside him.
Mate, he whispered hoarsely, let me do it. I'll find her. I'll have her out of Thebes tonight. I swear by—
You'll follow orders, Captain.
Sheftu flung him a look that left nothing but obedience in Nakonk's mind.
Come to the boat.
He slipped out of their hiding place and Nakonk followed. They plunged down the lane beside the warehouse, into the next dim street and then along it, parallel to the river, at a pace that left the captain no time to think or even feel. His mind had gone numb in any case. He knew they were making for the hidden boat, that they would cross the Nile and lie in wait for Mara somewhere on the other side, intercepting her as she was starting for the inn. He knew what was to happen in some dark alley, and that he could not prevent its happening. But it all seemed unreal, a nightmare from which he could not wake. They swerved back toward the river. A few minutes later, Nakonk was dragging the boat from the concealing papyrus stalks, still moving like an automaton.
Cast off the painter. I've a paddle here somewhere.
They pushed off across the black water, and with the familiar rocking motion, the feel of the paddle in his hand, Nakonk's numbness began to wear off. He pulled harder and more fiercely, so that the boat shot like a live thing through the current, but the exertion failed to stop his thoughts.
Bear to your left, Captain, said Sheftu at last. We'll make for that statue on the bank.
The fishing punt was there, moored to the great granite toe as always, and old Aank dozed nearby. Sheftu nudged him awake, none too gently, flipped him a debon, and ordered him home, then hurried up the bank.
She's a cold-blooded little traitor, Nakonk told himself desperately, as he tied their own boat and hurried to follow.
Did she give a thought to you when she decided to turn informer? Or even to Sheftu?
She's earned what's coming. She'd have run the whole plot aground if she could.
Just don't think. Don't look at her. Remember, don't look at her.
This will serve, said Sheftu coolly. I believe she's coming.
Nakonk emerged abruptly from his preoccupation. They stood in an alley. Ahead, up its murky, narrow length, he could just make out a slender, cloak-swathed figure hurrying through the shadows. Nakonk wet his lips and glanced around him, wishing he could stop going hot and cold like a man with a fever. Sheftu had chosen his spot well. The lane was deserted, closed in by buildings that would remain dark and empty until morning. There would be no one to disturb them.
Walk casually to meet her, murmured Sheftu.
He strolled forward, and Akonk trailed after him, wiping his sweaty palms on his thighs. Presently, Mara drew close enough to catch sight of them, and he could hear her sharp little intake of breath as she halted. An instant later, she recognized them.
Sheftu.
Her voice was low, but it held only surprise and pleasure, no fear. She moved swiftly to join them, looking from one to the other in amusement.
What is this, pray? An ambush?
One might call it so,
answered Sheftu silkily.
Come. I want a word with you.
He took her arm and guided her to a recessed doorway, while Nakonk drifted a little apart, where he could watch both ends of the alley. He could hear Mara's uneasy little laugh.
Have all the words you wish, but why choose this place? At the inn we could—
You'll not be going to the inn tonight.
Why will I not?
She hesitated, and her tone changed.
Sheftu, you're acting strange. Is aught amiss?
Aye, much is amiss.
The vessel Friend of the Wind was raided tonight by the Queen's soldiers.
She gave a gasp Nakonk could have sworn was genuine.
Osiris, with all the gold aboard her? Aye, when you traveled the shores of the night to bring it back. Nay, they can't, they mustn't. Those...
Her voice broke with fury, and for a moment her language reeked of Menfi's waterfront.
But shall we do naught but wail of it for the love of Amun? We must do something. You must do something, Sheftu. You're the leader.
Aye, a brilliant leader.
Sheftu's voice remained quiet, but the whiplash Nakonk had been dreading came into it now.
I've saved Egypt with one hand and destroyed her with the other, by trusting a maid as faithless as the wind.
Mother of the gods, whispered Mara. You think I did it?
My lovely Mara, no doubt exists.
But I didn't do it. I didn't. There must have been another who listened. I didn't do it. Sheftu, the juggler, that's who it was. He was there. Ask Nakonk. He heard everything. It was that babbling Sohore. May the devourer take him. I knew he'd betray us before we'd done with him. Did I not tell you, warn you?
I was certain you would place the blame elsewhere.
Ast, Sheftu, you're blind. You've ever been blind about that rogue. And look you now. All the gold gone. The plans ruined.
Mara, said Sheftu softly. There was no gold on the ship.
There was a sudden silence. Nakonk edged toward them without knowing what he did. He was beginning to feel as if he could not breathe. Suppose it were Sohore. It could have been. It was possible. Even probable. Then, by all the gods...
Stay away from her, Captain,
ordered Sheftu.
Mara drew a soft, irregular breath. Why? She whispered. Should the captain stay away from me?
Because he has revealed an unfortunate weakness where you're concerned, said Sheftu.
He moved closer to her. For the first time, he was failing to hide the strain he was under. Nakonk could see the tension in his shoulders, and his voice had grown harsh and thick.
This affair is between you and me, little one. Do you understand? Let me make it quite clear to you. There was no gold on the ship, nor was it our ship. The news was false. It was a trap, Mara, and you walked into it.
Sheftu, I did not betray you. I swear by my Ka.
Ast, be silent. I know all about you. All. I know you're a slave in the Queen's pay. And have been since you took ship with us in Menfi. I know you lied to me then, and have lied to me every day I've known you, and would go on lying until the end of time if it would get you what you want.
Your master believed you, didn't he? I know of that, too. How cleverly you've played both sides, waiting, holding back, until last night you thought you'd chosen certain victory.
Mara was slowly, almost imperceptibly, backing away from him, though she seemed scarcely to move or even breathe. Suddenly she whirled to run. Just as suddenly, Sheftu's hand shot out and seized her wrist. In a flash, he had doubled her arm behind her and jerked her close to him. He held a gleaming knife in his other hand.
"Not this time, little one,"
he said softly. His rough handling had caused the cloak to fall away from her hair, and the fragrance of lotuses now drifted through the alley. Nikonk flattened stiffly against the building opposite, tried to look away and couldn't. His eyes were fastened on the knife blade, and he became gradually aware that it was trembling.
"Have you kept him satisfied, I wonder?"
whispered Sheftu.
"That master of yours, whoever he is, what have you told him? How much have you told him?"
Mara, too, was staring at the knife, shrinking away from it as far as his grip would let her.
"Sheftu," she breathed, "you can't do it. You can't."
"Ah, can I not? Who will ever know or care?"
She looked up at him suddenly, and then Nikonk witnessed a very strange thing. Instead of shrinking from the knife, she flung herself close against Sheftu, twined her free arm about his neck, and kissed him on the mouth. What happened next was never clear in Nikonk's mind. He was aware of a strangled oath from Sheftu, the clatter of a knife hitting the gravel, and felt Mara hurtle against him as if she had been thrown. Instinctively, Nikonk wrapped his arms about her and whirled her so that his own body shielded her.
"Take her, Captain,"
gasped a voice that might have been Lord Sheftu's.
"Take her out of Thebes, out of Egypt, anywhere, but let me never see her again."
Hasty footsteps plunged away up the alley, pounded around a corner, and were gone. When Nikonk's head cleared a little, he found that he was cursing steadily and idiotically under his breath, still clutching Mara tight in his arms. He stopped, wet his shaking lips, and loosened his hold to peer down at her. She was weeping stormily. He did not know whether in anger or in fright.
"Is all well with you, little one?"
he muttered.
"He didn't harm you?"
She shook her head, burrowed harder against his chest, and continued to sob. He held her uneasily, patting her shoulder now and then, and growling vague comfort under his breath. He was not used to weeping maidens and had no idea what one did for them. But he felt dimly that it would be best to let her weep her fill. Presently, the storm subsided a little, and after a moment she stirred and lifted her head.
"Nikonk, where is he?"
"Gone, little one. Likely halfway to the Falcon by this time."
"He'll go there?"
"Aye, I think so. He'll want to make sure all's well, and besides..."
"Besides what?"
"Well, little one,"
said Nikonk gruffly,
"I think he'll be warning them about you."
"Ordering them to murder me on sight, I'll wager," she burst out. "Just on the chance you'll not take me far enough to the ends of the earth."
"Aye, just on the chance, just on the chance,"
he soothed.
"But we'll not founder on that sandbar until we hit it. I must take you away, little one. You know that, don't you?"
She stirred fretfully against him, and he dropped his arms, studying her profile in the gloom.
"Look, you maid, how much of that was true? What he accused you of?"
"Oh." Her hand had wandered to the crushed lotus in her hair. She pulled it out, looked at it a moment, and dropped it to the ground.
"All of it, Nikonk, save about the ship.
Sahore told that he must have, because I never did. I never even meant to. I swear I've told not." She broke off,
seemed to hold her breath a moment. At least, not much.
She suddenly went on.
As for the rest, can I be blamed for that? I didn't ask to be sold. But, Mother of Truth, it was a chance to be free, perhaps rich. What did I know about the king then? I'd not even met Sheftu. Once I did, then I wished I'd never seen that cursed master of mine. But, Nekonk, I've told him naught that matters. I've but played hounds and jackals with him. I had to do that, didn't I? If I'd not done it, he'd have thrown me back in the gutter.
Aye, she's just a child, Nekonk was thinking. A little waif in a cursed, ugly world, and none to befriend her.
No matter, it's past now,
he muttered, patting her awkwardly.
We'll have a fine voyage, clean to Crete, if you like. Crete's a good land, little one. An island. A mite odd and foreign, but pleasant, and lively enough even for you. They've acrobats there, men and maids both, who dance about under the horns of bulls and leap over their backs so that you've never seen the like. You'll be no slave, either, and I'll wager you could sell that ring of yours for 100 gold deben. Aye, come, little blue eye. Crete's the place. Let's be out of this dark alley.
You're good to me, Nekonk, whispered Mara, and I'll come, but...
She hesitated, resisting when he tried to draw her forward.
What's amiss now, maid?
Nekonk, how do we know he's gone? He might be waiting just yonder around the corner, or he might have changed his mind and come back.
Nay, don't worry. He's gone.
How can you be sure?
Now then, if it'll ease your mind, I'll make certain of it. Come, stand in the doorway here. It'll take but a moment.
Guiding her gently into the niche, the captain walked up the alley in the direction Sheftu had taken. He knew he would find no one. Her fears were needless, but he well understood them, and meant to humor every one if it would help her. The winds had tossed her craft enough, he thought belligerently, in her 17 short years. It was time somebody steered a straight course for her. As he had expected, the street beyond was quite deserted. He examined several dark nooks nearby, so he could tell her he'd done so, then strode back into the alley. The first moonbeams were beginning to sift their way into it now. Out in the open, on the river, it would soon be bright enough to navigate with fair accuracy. It would be a good night to sail, Nekonk decided. Though it might not be wise to venture into those currents beyond the sandbars. They'd slip downstream a few miles and tie up until... The captain halted and frowned about him uncertainly. Was this not the doorway? He glanced back the way he had come, wondering if he'd misjudged the distance, decided perhaps he had, and started on. Then he stopped abruptly. There, in the gravel at his feet, the moonlight glittered over the blade of a jeweled knife, and a cubit or two away lay a crumpled lotus.
Mother of Amun,
whispered the captain.
The doorway was empty. The whole alley was empty. And that knife, or another, would likely be slicing his own throat before morning if he didn't find that slippery maid and bring her back.
Mother of Amun and Isis and Osiris and the sacred cat of Bast,
he exploded. He scooped up the dagger, clamped his jaw at its fiercest, and started up the alley, running hard.
Chapter 22 Disaster. 3 streets away, Mara was already dodging out of the passage beside the goldsmith's shop, and running like the desert antelope along the high, curving wall which bounded the palace grounds. There was but one thing to do, and somehow, through the wild disorder of her emotions, she'd had wit enough to see it and cling fast to it. She was still spent from her storm of weeping, sore in body and mind from Sheftu's merciless handling of her, and shaken in every nerve by the audacious, but no less passionate, kiss which had saved her life. Shefty was lost to her beyond recall. But hardest to bear was the ironic twist that this time she was innocent. The ship's raid was none of her doing. It was Sahore he'd caught in his gold-baited trap. But he'd refused to believe it, and thereby laid himself and the revolution open to the liveliest danger. Mara alone, though stunned by the abruptness of her own undoing, recognized the extent of that danger. She alone knew that Nahere knew about the Inn of the Falcon. She alone could guess that in his rage at finding nothing on the ship, he might abandon all subtler tactics and storm the tavern, seizing everyone in it and trusting to later luck to find the leader. Aye, but he would already have the leader. The moment he set eyes on Sashai, the scribe, he would recognize Lord Sheftu and all would be over. There was but one thing to do. Find Nahere, learn his plans, and then, if necessary, slip away from him somehow and carry a warning to the inn. On trembling legs, Mara was speeding to do it. The north gate loomed ahead, Reshed's gate. Mara clutched her ring, praying its charm would work once more, though Amun knew it had brought her anything but luck the last 2 days. She had not seen Reshed for 4 nights now, having lately used the main gate and the password of her master's name for her passage in and out of the palace grounds. She knew not what temper Reshed would be in, but she had to try him. She might need desperately to get out again later, and by that time the use of Nahere's name might be suicidal. Breathless, she halted before the gate, tried in vain to quiet her pounding heart, and finally rapped 3 times. Reshed recognized the signal. She could hear the faint, sharp clatter of his sword as he made a startled move. An instant later, the gate swung open, just far enough for his body to block the entrance. "You," he growled.
"I, Reshed, I'm in haste. Please let me in."
"What are you doing out? That's what I want to know. I've seen naught of you tonight, not for 4 nights running."
"Why, today I went out much earlier, with my princess, at another gate. And before that, ah, Reshed, I've wanted to come, if only to linger a moment with you and then go back again. But I could never get away from her, not even for a minute."
"Aye, very likely. More likely you found some other simpleton to dry your tears and let you in and out whenever you crook a finger at him."
Reshed reached out furiously and jerked her closer.
"Who is it? That swell-headed sergeant at the main gate?"
"Nay, it isn't, it isn't. I've done no such thing. Oh, mother of truth, let me in. I can't stand here arguing. I'm in haste, I tell you. My brother's dying, and I must get help."
She twisted violently in his grasp, but only succeeded in reversing their positions, so that it was she who stood with her back to the gate, which hung tantalizingly ajar. He still held her arm fast.
"You never had a brother," he said bitterly. "I don't know whom you meet outside there, but I'll stake my sword he's no sick kinsman. I've caught on to your game, you little witch, though I've been cursed slow about it. You've made a fool of me, letting me risk my post here night after night so you could—"
"Reshed, I beg you, I swear by my Ka—"
Tears of despair choked off the words and changed to sobs of fury. She began to fight him like a wildcat, kicking, clawing, beating at him, spitting out her rage.
"Let go of me, you stupid clod! I've done naught to you! You've got your cursed post still, haven't you? Let me go, you devil!"
Suddenly she froze, staring just beyond his shoulder.
"Great Amun, your captain!"
He spun around, and for just that instant his fingers loosened. An instant was all Mara needed. In a flash, she had wrenched away and darted through the gate, up the avenue of rams, and into the court of the weavers, leaving him cursing bitterly behind her. Let him curse, she thought as she sped silently along the graveled paths.
He can't leave his gate without raising an alarm, and if he does that, he'll lose his precious post and maybe his head for his part in this affair. But, oh, Amon, now how was she to get out of the grounds again in case she had to? She slowed, almost halted, in an agony of hesitation. Should she go back? Try to make amends? Try to... Nay, the thing was done now. There was no undoing it. Sick with apprehension, she darted on. She reached the great court of storerooms, some distance beyond the stair she ordinarily climbed to the upper corridor and her own chambers. There she stopped, leaned panting against the rough plastered wall, and tried to picture in her mind the plan of the palace Nahare had showed her. The little study he had told her of was near this courtyard, she was sure of that. But which passage? That one, to the right. Aye, it must be, for the other led only to the guard room. It was the one she and Anani had walked down that day toward the audience with the queen. How long ago that seemed. She moved quickly into the passage to the right, turned right again into a dimly lighted hall, and counted the doors as she passed them. 1, 2, 3, 4. It was that one. Without allowing herself to pause or even wonder what would happen next, she opened the door, slipped through into a torchlit, crowded room, and closed the door behind her. Lord Nahare turned from a group of excited soldiers and rivermen and stared at her.
"You!"
he burst out. Mara leaned back against the door, feeling all at once spent and weary. "Everyone," she thought sardonically, "seems overjoyed to see me tonight."
"Yes, I," she said. "I crave your protection, Master. The rebels suspect me."
"Do they? By my Ka, Amon is good sending you here at this moment. It has saved my Libyan the trouble of finding you."
Slowly, he eased down upon the table behind him, folded his arms, and studied her, a faint chill smile touching the corners of his mouth.
"Shadzar," he murmured, "send these men away. We need them no longer."
The Libyan jerked his head at the soldiers and rivermen, crewmen from the Friend of the Wind, Mara guessed, and herded them out through another door. There was still one other person in the room, a quiet figure hunched in the shadows of one corner. But Mara did not move her eyes to see who it was. As the Libyan sauntered back to his post, Lord Nahare spoke again, his voice dripping sarcasm.
"So the rebels suspect you. How unkind of them to repay your friendship with cruel distrust."
"Friendship? I've pretended friendship, Master. Did you not send me there to spy on them, learn their secrets?"
"Aye, quite right, I did. But you were so tardy in reporting any of those secrets that this afternoon I decided to set a spy on you, my clever one. Only a formality, you understand. To my surprise, the man I picked seemed to be an old friend of yours already."
"Indeed," murmured Mara.
Lord Nahare turned his head.
"You, there! Show yourself!"
Even before she saw him, Mara knew who was gliding out of his shadowy corner. Sahore looked oddly incomplete without his golden balls, but his twisted, cynical smile was the same as ever, his tongue as oily.
"Live forever, face of the lily. May thy Ka rejoice. May thy..."
"Est, you son of 40 devils!"
"Shocking," murmured Lord Nahare. "Is that any way to greet a friend?"
"He's no friend of mine. He's a rogue and a serpent. Don't trust a word he says, Master. He's as slippery as..."
"Then you're two of a kind."
Nahare's pretense was finished now. His voice lashed like a whip.
"Why did you not tell me of that ship tonight?"
"Because I knew it was a trap."
"By Amon, you'd still lie to me?"
"Don't believe her, Excellency,"
put in Sahure.
She was there. She heard what I heard.
Yes, I was there, you crocodile. But I had my wits about me, and you did not. The ship was empty, master, was it not? You found no gold aboard it, did you? Nay, you didn't. It was all a hoax. A snare set for me that I had the sense to stay away from. But this fool walked into it. Now they think I did it, and all I've tried to accomplish is wrecked. They'll not even let me in the tavern after this. In fact, I hear they've orders to kill me on sight.
Ah, breathed Lord Nahere with satisfaction. And just who told you that?
Mara bit her lip until she could taste the blood. An old man, who felt sorry for me.
Indeed, someone whose acquaintance you've made during those other visits to the inn, no doubt. Those early visits. The ones before I sent you. The ones I knew nothing about until this juggler told me.
Gods of Egypt, I'm caught, thought Mara. I can't wriggle out of this one. There's no way out. No way out. She parted stiff lips, but no words came rushing to her tongue from that mysterious reservoir of last-minute inspiration which had so often saved her. She stood paralyzed, wordless, and the silence drew out until it was far too long, far too late now to say anything at all. And she was lost. It was all over. Lord Nahere smiled icily and echoed her thoughts.
The game's over, isn't it? Too bad. You must have enjoyed it while it lasted. Come now. Who was this old man who warned you?
The silence went on.
Excellency, murmured Sahore, I think perhaps it was a young man, one called Sashai. He would have warned her.
A faint, bitter amusement touched the edges of Mara's mind. Not he, she muttered. Nahere ignored her, turning instead to the juggler.
It is sad indeed that I was not aware earlier of your possibilities. You would have been working for me long ago. Before those soldiers came in with their useless prisoners, you were beginning to tell me of those who come regularly to this inn. Suppose you continue. Sashai, the scribe. Who is this scribe?
Excellency, no one knows. It is he who brings orders from the rebel leader, and no one knows him either. It is said even Sashai has never seen him. But it is clear to all that our scribe is smitten with this lily-faced one here, this flower of loveliness.
Sahore's world-weary, indifferent eyes rested a moment on Mara, faintly amused, detached, as they might have rested on a stranger. A carven image, a beetle which he had chanced to crush under his sandal.
As for the others, there is a goldsmith. His name is Nefer. Ashore, the innkeeper and his wife. A priest called Jedet. A riverman, Nekunk. A baker. And several artisans.
He did it easily, casually, as if there were nothing here requiring thought or decision. He merely opened his mouth and named them off. Her companions, her allies, all Sheftu's trusted followers. Those who had laughed with her and counted her one of them. Who ate Miftaya's stew or whispered with Sashai or played hounds and jackals night after night while they waited for orders. Named them, and so murdered them, one by one. Mara stood dry-mouthed, sick and numbing all over, gazing at last into the face of treachery, with which she had been flirting so long. She could not wrench her eyes away from that unbelievable, sinuous figure with its twisted shoulder, its gestures of fluid grace. It seemed as if evil itself were loose in the room.
"Enough, enough," Nahere was saying absently. "We can net all those when we choose, like a school of fish. It is the scribe who interests me,
this mysterious Sashai. There, juggler, is a fish who might be worth catching. In fact, I think we will cast our net. Shadzar!
Aye, master.
Call the soldiers back. There'll be another raid. Tonight. At once. Stay. Send me only their sergeant. I'll give my orders to him. What of her?
Nahere's cold eyes moved to Mara.
Later. I want plenty of time for that. Plenty of time. Send her to her chambers and post a guard by her door. Perhaps it had better be you. Nay, I want you for this other. Put her under guard. Find a guard with a whip.
He smiled thinly at Mara.
We will meet again, too clever one.
Come,
muttered the Libyan. Moving like one in an ugly dream, Mara walked beside him through the other doorway, waited while he chose a burly soldier and growled instructions, went on again with her new guard through the halls, up the outside stair to the upper corridor, and at last into her own room. He left her there, standing motionless, among the familiar gilded butterflies. A moment later, she heard the bolt grate home, then the creak of wood as her jailer settled back against her door. It was some moments before she became dimly aware of the sounds of movement and chatter from the next room. At first, she resisted them vaguely, as one brushes away a buzzing fly. But in spite of herself, the numbness began to wear away, the fog to clear from her mind. That was Inanni and the Syrian women she heard in there, talking calmly together as on any other evening, perhaps putting away their games and embroidery, yawning good night. There was another door, the one opening onto the hall from that sitting room. No use, she thought. It's but a step down the hall. The guard would see anyone who went in or out. He guards that one, too, or might as well. Without plan or any hope, she moved across her room and passed through the tapestry-hung door into the sitting room. She had been right. The Syrians were in the act of dispersing to their sleeping chambers. A few of them paused to look at her in mild surprise. Inanni's face showed a flicker of swift anxiety.
Mara, I thought you were... Is anything wrong?
My princess, said Mara in a voice that sounded strange even to herself.
Could I speak to you a moment? For as long as you like.
Inanni murmured something to Dashtar, waved all of her women out of the room, and hurried over to Mara.
Sit you down. Your face is ashen. Shall I fetch water?
Nay, I'm all right. Stay with me, please, my princess. Grasping blindly at Inanni's hand, Mara sank onto a couch and, to her own bewilderment, burst into despairing tears.
Mara, oh, something terrible has happened, has it not? I felt it the moment you came in here. There now, you shall tell me about it in a moment. Don't try yet. All's well. All's well. Oh, Amon, I've no time for weeping. I must stop this.
Mara brushed the tears angrily from her face, only to be overcome with fresh ones.
Everything's tumbled about my ears, princess. All's over. All's wrecked, smashed. Sheftu tried to kill me tonight. He couldn't do it, quite, but my master can and means to and will. There's a guard outside my door now, and I must get out. I must warn them.
As coherently as she could, she told the story. The ship. The black moment in the alley. Her flight from Nakank, then from Reshed, and the terrible scene she had just witnessed.
Aye, princess, that juggler is the evil one himself. It was the way he did it, carelessly, without passion, as if lives are of no more value than onions, and naught means anything. Oh, Cyrus, I knew not what evil thing I played with. I did not know it would be like this. I didn't understand. Mara, Mara.
Inanni stroked her hair, trembling.
Is there nothing you can do? Nothing. I can't leave these rooms. Even if I could, I'd never get outside the gates. I'm snared fast as a bird in a net. Inanni stilled suddenly, then seized Mara's shoulders in both hands. Wait, Mara, it's possible that... it may be that I can help you to get out. You what? How? What? Hush, let me tell you. Do you remember Shirimi, the Syrian woman in the court of the weavers? The one I... You've been seeing her, I knew that. She has a family outside the gates, Mara, in the city of the dead. Often she goes home to them each night, though if the work presses, here, she stays on until it slackens and sleeps in a little room off the servants' wing. She is in the palace now. I talked with her this afternoon, and she said she would sleep within the walls tonight. But if she were to change her mind, if she were to rise from her couch now and go home to her family outside the gates, taking a young Syrian maid with her... Mara was on her feet.
Aye, praise and thanksgiving be to...
Quick, princess, find me Syrian clothes, all the scarves and shawls and thick skirts you can gather. Stay. Do you think she'll do this for me?
She will do it for me, Mara, said Inanni softly. We have comforted each other, and it is as if I were her daughter and she my own kin.
Mara stood for one silent moment, searching the simple, tranquil face and glimpsing a world which she had never known, a world of friends and kin who shared bread and trouble alike and comforted one another.
And you would do it for me? She whispered.
With all my heart. It is not much I do. Inanni started for her bedchamber, then hesitated. Suddenly she rushed back to seize Mara's hands, her plump face creased with anxiety.
But it is much, and more than much, that you do, Mara. Oh, think carefully. Once outside the walls, you could go free. They will kill you if you go to that inn. You said so yourself.
I don't care. I don't care. Make haste the clothes.
Inanni dropped her hands and flew to the door of her bedchamber. Chapter 23. Capture. 5 minutes later, two Syrians in gaudy draperies emerged from the Princess Inanni's suite and started for the stair. Down the hall, the guard's sword clattered as he straightened.
Stay! Who's that?
Two shawled heads turned inquiringly toward him, and there was a vague, sibilant mumble of Babylonian, a shrugging of shoulders. He hesitated, but then settled back against the door.
Aye, never mind. Go on, go on.
The Syrians padded to the stair and disappeared. A few minutes later, one of them returned alone, let herself quietly into the room, and drew the bolt behind her. At the same moment, Mara was walking beside Shirimi the weaver through the main gate of the palace grounds, carrying a basket of linen warp on her head and echoing the Syrian's casual good night to the sentry.
By my ka, Shirimi, he remarked in surprise. You're a little late, are you not? All Thebes is asleep long since. Who's that with you?
Only a new apprentice, answered Shirimi. I must hasten, sentry. My son is ill, and already my work has kept me too long from him.
May the Starry One send him rest,
yawned the sentry absently.
Good night.
Out of sight, around the curving wall, Mara pressed the woman's hand in silent thanks, then flung off the heavy draperies and stuffed them into the basket. Shirimi took them and went her way, while Mara, feeling fleet as air in her own thin Egyptian sheath, sped toward the goldsmith's shop, across the street to the dark entrance, and straight into the arms of Nekunk.
Hi,
he growled, seizing her as if he never meant to let go.
So I've snared you at last, my bird on the wing, and this time I'll wager you'll not slip away from...
Mara clapped a hand over his mouth. Nekunk, you're the very one I want. Oh, Amun, how glad I am to see you. Quick, quick to the river. We must find a boat. They're going to raid the tavern. Make haste, I tell you.
They're what? Who?
Nekunk was moving beside her, even while he protested, but he kept a firm grip on her arm. As quickly as she could, Mara explained, meanwhile tugging him on through the dark streets.
I know not when they started, even if they've started, but there's a chance we may get there first. They had soldiers to call together, orders to give. The Devourer, take you, will you hurry? Cease your pulling back.
I mean to stand still, said Nekunk bluntly, and did so. Let me set my teeth into this. Nay, stop tugging at me, it'll do you no good. Now tell me why I should believe a word of this wild tale when not an hour ago...
Asked, I know I tricked you, Nekunk. I had to. You'd not have listened if I'd tried to... In the name of Amun, would I be going to the tavern at all if it weren't to warn them? You know well how they feel toward me by this time. Unless you hasten, it's you who'll betray them. You who'll murder them one by one.
So be it. Hush, hush. No need to shriek at me.
Nekunk was moving now, raking the riverbank with his glance as they ran down the last slope.
Mind you, I don't say I believe you, but I'll take no chance on... None of your tricks, though, Miss Blue Eyes. You'll not get out of my sight from now to Crete, do you understand? By Amun, I think I'll tie a hawser to you and make certain... Here's a boat. We'll borrow it now and ask leave some other...
Nekunk, listen!
Both of them froze in the act of climbing into the boat. Somewhere back in the dark maze of streets, there was a sound of rhythmic footsteps, a barked order, the clank of weapons.
They're coming! Gasped Mara. Make haste, make haste! Now, do you believe me?
For answer, Nekunk shoved her into the boat, tumbled in after her, and pushed off with a stroke of such violent energy that it seemed to take them halfway across the Nile. Grim and silent, he devoted all his attention to keeping the boat moving at a speed Mara would have marveled at any time but now. Now, no matter how fast they went, the boat seemed to crawl. Her gaze was fastened fearfully on the receding riverbank.
There they are, she cried. I can see them, Nekunk. They'll take that ferry barge, I'll wager. It's the only craft big enough to hold them all. Oh, hurry, hurry.
The barge was well past the middle of the river when the little boat bumped the wharf on the east bank. Nekunk tied the painter in an instant and scrambled up the water-soaked ladder, pulling Mara behind him. Together they plunged into the gloomy alleys of the waterfront district.
You must tell them, Nekunk. I daren't go in, panted Mara as they ran. They'll believe you.
And where will you be,
he snapped, if I let you slip away again?
Oh, what do I matter now? Put your wits to work, Captain. If I live to reach Crete, it's more than I hope for anyway.
Nekunk flung open the gate and they halted, breathless.
I'll wait, gasped Mara. I swear I'll wait. There, in the corner.
Nekunk loosed her arm at last and sprinted for the door. Stumbling to the farthest, darkest corner of the courtyard, Mara huddled there, trying to catch her breath and listening for the clatter of weapons in the streets beyond. She heard them all too soon. But before that, she heard Nekunk's voice in the tavern, followed by scrambling activity. Then the sound of the rear door banging open and soft, hasty footsteps scattering in all directions. They were still hurrying stealthily by her on the other side of the courtyard wall when the heavy ones, the bold ones, pounded up the street.
Naught holds me here, thought Mara, shrinking against the wall. I could climb up these vines and be over the wall and away.
But she did not move. She had told Nekunk she would wait.
And just once in her life, she meant to do what she said.
She could hear the swords clanking now, and the painting, and see the orange glow of torchlight over the wall yonder, on the buildings across the street.
Nekunk, come. Nekunk, come, she thought. Make haste.
And there he was at last, in the doorway, beckoning to her. She darted out of her corner, and the first soldiers burst at that moment through the gate.
In the name of the queen,
a hoarse voice bellowed. Mara flung herself back.
Nekank vanished, and the raiders poured into the courtyard.
Gods of Egypt, they are everywhere, Mara was thinking, as she flattened herself against the vines.
Swarming over the courtyard like angry bees, dashing into the tavern and through it, shouting, cursing, and from the sound of it, breaking every piece of crockery Miftaya owned. Some ran out the back. She could hear them beating about the alleys, calling to one another, growling their fury that for the second time that night, their prey had eluded them.
Mara found herself laughing silently, clutching the vines in wild excitement. They all went free. She exulted. You sons of crocodiles, they all slid through your claws, everyone. Then a light glared in her face.
Who's that?
Cried a voice.
Bast! I found one, at least. Come out of there.
A rough hand dragged her forth.
Look you, it's a maid.
A maid?
Echoed another voice, one she knew. She twisted about to face Shadzar the Libyan.
By the sacred horns of Hathor, he exploded, what hath spirited you out of the palace, with a guard at the door and every sentry warned?
Mara loosed her held-in laughter. It rang clear and mocking and triumphant through the courtyard and the empty inn.
You daughter of 40 devils, spat the Libyan,
grabbing for his whip.
I'll teach you to laugh at me.
From long habit, Mara flung an arm over her face, half crouching. The first savage, familiar bite of the lash quenched her laughter. As she gasped under the second and the third and the fourth, she knew her 30 short days of freedom were at an end. When Mara walked into the great audience chamber of the Golden House, weary, sore, with hands bound tight behind her, it seemed a different room from the one she had entered the morning of Inanni's audience with the queen. Now, soldiers, instead of courtiers, stood in groups about it, and torches blazed on every wall, throwing dancing, dazzling reflections over the dais and the electrum throne which stood tall and empty, awaiting its occupant. Not gentle Inanni, but Shadzar stood beside Mara, whip in hand. And no Lord Sheftu lounged with deceptive laziness in the background, ready to throw her a glance of encouragement, devise a way out. Instead, there was Senmut, the architect, hastily summoned from his bed and talking in low tones with his brother Nahere. And there was no way out. Count Senmut's ravaged face showed a fierce elation. He kept looking over his shoulder toward the door leading to the queen's private apartments.
I made her summons urgent,
Mara heard him murmur.
And we'd best wait. She'll want to do the questioning herself.
Amun, what luck this is! Now perhaps that cursed affair of the bodyguard will be forgotten. Her radiance has shown me naught but the edge of her tongue these last few days, I must confess. You say this slave girl's your only capture?
Aye, but she's enough, provided she'll speak truth.
Senmut glanced at Mara, his cheeks furrowing with a faint, contemptuous smile.
There are ways to ensure that.
Mara heard him as from a great distance. None of this seemed quite believable. Disasters had fallen in such a deadly rain that she felt dazed by now. The night seemed to have been going on forever like a chaotic dream. Only the fresh welts across her shoulders were vividly real. They throbbed without ceasing, each stripe separately, like crisscrossed bands of fire.
I have grown soft, she thought,
or else this Libyan's hand is heavier than Zasha's ever was. There was a sudden stir among those who stood nearest the inner door.
Now we'll see,
breathed Senmut with satisfaction. He crossed the room quickly. The soldiers effaced themselves against the walls, and the Libyan gave Mara a shove which sent her sprawling on her face, unable to catch herself because of her bound wrists. The whole company dropped to their knees as the door swung open.
Behold,
intoned the chamberlain.
The majesty of the Black Land, Horus of gold, enduring of kingships, splendid of diadems, ruler of Upper and Lower Egypt.
Enough! Rang Hatshepsut's high, metallic voice, accompanied by the whisper of her sandals across the floor. I care not for ceremony in the middle of the night. Count Senmet, what I pray you is of such vast importance that I be roused from my couch at this hour. Move that cursed cushion. I like it not.
Mara lay tensely quiet, intensely aware. Everything was real now. Too real. Her shoulders burned with fresh pain from her wrenching fall, and the architect's soothing tones turned her sick with dread.
Your Radiance will scarce regret the loss of a little sleep when you hear my news. I have this night, with some help from my esteemed brother Lord Nahere, struck the death blow at a conspiracy against your enduring Majesty's throne and person. The very conspiracy, in fact, that we have long suspected to be in progress, under the secret direction of your kinsman, the Pretender.
Fewer words, Count Senmet. Do you say you have caught the leaders? I see them not.
Majesty, this wretched slave girl you see before you,
she is the leader?
You ask me, said the queen waspishly, to believe that tale.
Shining One, my tale is not yet told, retorted Senmet. When you see the face of this wench, pull her up there.
Mara felt the Libyan's rough grasp. The next instant, she was on her knees, looking straight into the glittering dark eyes of Hatshepsut. The queen's face was beautiful as before, perhaps more so, for this time its femininity was not mocked by the tied-on ceremonial beard and the massive severity of the double crown. Confined only by a narrow golden circlet bearing the royal cobra, her hair fell loose about her shoulders, and she wore a flowing dressing gown instead of robes of state.
Blue eyes, she remarked. Where have I seen this girl before?
Daughter of the sun, she is the king.